You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's no exaggeration to say that antibiotics have saved millions of lives since their discovery or invention less than 100 years ago. But antibiotics are just one side of a biological war that's been raging for millions of years. And bacteria have responded to the widespread use of antibiotics the only way they know how, by evolving. Within years of penicillin's introduction, penicillin-resistant bacteria had already become a significant problem. Today, antibiotic-resistant bacteria account for more than 2 million infections and some 23,000 deaths each year. Experts have declared this an antibiotic resistance crisis and say we're headed toward a post-antibiotic era. It's a terrifying prospect, but there are possible solutions out there. Joining me now to talk about some of them is toxicologist and author Emily Monison. Her latest book is Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks. Great to be here.
All right, so you've written about the problem of antibiotic resistance in the past and how we got to where we are right now. But you start this book with this nice anecdote about, you know, you're giving a talk about the problem of antibiotic resistance. Somebody says, well, what do we do? And you didn't really have an answer. So you went looking for what we could possibly do. How hard was it to find? I mean, you've now got a whole book of possible solutions. How hard was it to dig them out?
It was really not that difficult. Some of these solutions that I write about are actually very old, kind of made new with new technologies. So there have been solutions out there. I think it's just getting them into development seems to be some of the problem. But
so one of the solutions that has gotten, I think, a fair bit of public attention in the past couple of years that definitely fits that mold of going way back for possible solutions is fecal transplants. How does this actually work? What's the health benefit of doing this?
Yeah, so, well, the fecal transplant is basically what it is. It's transplanting feces from one person to another, although it's not straight up feces. So I tell the story of a family that really needed to use fecal transplant. And so in the story I tell, the mother who ended up being the feces donor underwent a lot of testing. So before you transplant feces from one to another, you need to make sure that there's no disease or anything like that. There's nothing bad that you would transfer. And so you go through a lot of testing, and then they process it and then undergo a feces transplant.
But obviously, they're not sterilizing it, right? The whole point here is you're trying to get the gut bacteria from one person who's healthy to another person who is not healthy. Is this just a way to replenish bacteria, or can it actually actively fight an infection of some sort?
So I think, I think they're still trying to work out how this works and why it works. Although they do know that for certain infections like C. diff, which is a kind of hospital-acquired infection and also an opportunistic kind of infection, feces transplants really do seem to work. So it's not necessarily fending off, but what it's doing is this, like I said, it's an opportunistic infection, which means that if you're microbiome, which
all of the collection of microbes,
community of microbes that you have in your gut, if that gets out of whack from, say, taking antibiotics, a lot of us can deal with that. But if you can't and you're immunocompromised or something like that, by replacing that microbiome with a healthy microbiome, with a healthy sort of microbes that were in your gut before you were treated or in someone else's gut, can sort of push that out and sort of resettle. It's like recolonizing with a good community. And so that opportunistic infection can't really take hold.
I'm talking with author Emily Monison about her book, Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. So you call fecal transplants, and I think a number of the solutions you present, acts of ecology, which I thought was just a fun phrase. But, you know, kind of saying that many of the potential solutions lie in the realization that harmful bacteria are just one part of this huge collection and community of bacteria that we've been living with and evolving with for millions of years. So how do we capitalize on that idea and this concept of thinking about microbes more as part of an ecology?
So I think one of the things that's really come out of this, like you say, you know, microbes are a community. We're realizing that. And we're realizing how important communities are. And it's just like, if you think about our own communities, there are actors that are, there are people that are helpful and beneficial. There are people that are just there hanging out. And then there are people that are actually kind of protective. And so we have all this. And this is the same that I think scientists are beginning to realize with these microbial communities. And so one of the ways, one of the things that we're kind of learning is that when we do need to treat, say, an infection or one of those pathogenic or the bad bacteria, we're learning that it's more important to be very specific. And so a lot of our antibiotics are broad spectrum, which means that they'll kill a lot of different bacteria, not just that one that's causing a problem. And so one of the things we're learning, and this is, you know, not just in the human body, but even out in the farm field when, you know, microbes are important in the soil, it's important to try to go after those microbes that are the problems. And so if you can have a very specific solution to whether you're talking about microbes in a gut, insects in a farm field, whatever it is, if we can sort of keep the ecosystem intact and extract or deal with that one problem, we're much better off. And I think that's what we're learning. And I think there are some really interesting ways to do that.
You highlight another one in the book that highlights the fact that not only is this community made up of different bacteria, but viruses are part of that community naturally. Viruses can infect bacteria, and that may be something that we can harness and use to deal with bacterial infections in humans.
Yeah, that's one of the really cool things that I just really loved learning about. And so this is called, so viruses are everywhere, as we know. We're loaded with viruses. A lot of them aren't harming us. And in fact, a lot of them are infecting our bacteria. And these are called bacteriophages. So they're just viruses that infect bacteria. And what people knew over 100 years ago now, though they didn't know what they were working with, they knew that they could cure some infections with this sort of filtrate that had, what it ended up having was bacteriophages, these viruses that infect bacteria, in it, and it could cure disease. And so that kind of turned into, now this is a time before we had antibiotics, it was before penicillin, before sulfa drugs, way back in the early 1900s, was a when they realized that, you know, these little phages, they called them for short, could cure disease. And so various scientists and physicians started developing these phages as a therapy. And they were actually using them here in this country before antibiotics, and they were sold in pharmacies, and they went out of style in part because this was way before the analytics that we have. They didn't really know what they were working with. And so some of the treatment was sporadic, whether it worked or not. And so eventually that fell out of favor when antibiotics came into being. And also the medical community didn't like them. They weren't really regulated. So, like I said, the efficacy was uneven. So now that we have much better understanding of the microbiome and we have much better understanding of genetics and we can identify viruses much more easily, we can begin to use these viruses that will infect bacteria that are problematic, like MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph, is a common one that can be treated with these viruses.
Is that actually happening? I mean, whether it's fecal transplants or using viruses, first of all, some of these more natural defenses, as you call them in the title of the book, maybe come with a little bit of an ooh factor, or maybe seem a little bit off-putting to people because we've spent so long thinking that feces is a source of infection and viruses are you know, there to make you sick. Maybe a little bit difficult to accept that these are the things that could actually make us healthy. How's it being handled within the medical community and in terms of regulations?
That is a really good point, because I think that there's this ooh factor, and there's also this sort of, oh, you know, viruses, not viruses. Would you take viruses in your body intentionally? And the same thing with feces. And so, and it turns out that the people that I spoke to, the patients that use these therapies, were desperate. So right now, it's become, these are methods of desperation. Fecal transplant, at the time, I had interviewed the family that I mentioned earlier that used fecal transplant. It wasn't really a legal thing. It was kind of an under-the-radar treatment back then when they used it, which was probably about 10 years ago now. And now it's actually something that physicians can use under certain circumstances. So with the phage therapy, so that's called phage therapy, the virus therapy, is something that is actually used in, there's an institution in Tbilisi, Georgia, so very far away. But they've been using this for decades in developing it. But here in the U.S., there's phage therapy doesn't exist as a legal treatment. But because it's been so effective, when people do use it, and there are stories of these miraculous cures, I spoke to someone who's with the Homeland Biosecurity. I can't remember the exact title of him, but he's working with the FDA, and they're trying to figure, and scientists here and physicians trying to figure out how they can sort of move phage and test it appropriately so that it can kind of move into our own pharmacopoeia, and that maybe someday we'll be able to use phage therapy.
So maybe slowly making some progress there. Mm-hmm. My guest is Emily Monison. She's author of Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. Having written this book, how do you personally feel about the diminishing effectiveness of antibiotics? Is it still as terrifying, or do you feel like, you know, we have some tools available to us? I think we can weather this.
I still think it's kind of terrifying because these things are coming, but they're not online yet. And, you know, it takes many years of testing and development to make sure that something works and that it's safe. And we know that there are diseases now, TB, gonorrhea, other diseases are becoming completely antibiotic resistant. And so this is a problem now. There are infections that just are not curable. And I think it strikes fear into physicians and public health docs, because not only, when bacteria are very good at sharing their resistance, this is one of the problems. And so if there's some infection that's really not common in the population that has become completely antibiotic resistant, it's a potential threat to all of us, because if that happens to share its resistance, exchange that genetic material with a bacterium that's more common cause of infection, then that could happen fairly rapidly. We would be in trouble. But, you know, they're monitoring it, and I have read that some of the most resistant infections haven't spread yet, but I think there's a fear that it doesn't take a whole lot for these to spread. So even though there are these hopeful solutions, you know, we're not going to all of a sudden have phage therapy here in 2 years, which is why people here who have those resistant infections travel all the way to Tbilisi, Georgia, to be treated. So, you know, hopefully there'll be more exchange, but I think it's going to be slow going.
Emily Monison is a member of the Ronan Institute of Independent Scholarship, an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts, and her latest book is Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.